Welcome to the Recruitment Flex with Serge and Shelly. I'm Serge.
And I'm Shelly. And we talk all things recruitment starting right now.
Bonjour and welcome to the Recruitment Flex. Shelly, I'm really excited about this guest because we met him at HR Tech and I screwed up when we interviewed him. I forgot to unpress the mute button on his mic. So we finally had to get him on because we love the message and what this gentleman is doing. So Shelly, please introduce our guests.
Absolutely. Thank you, Serge. And yeah, you'd think after 300 episodes, you'd know to look for the mute button. Anyways, it is my pleasure to finally welcome to the show someone I really admire, a company I really admire. We have joining us the CEO of HackAJob, Mark Chaffee. Mark, thank you for joining us.
Shelly, Serge, thank you so much for having me. I think that it's a blessing that our interview never happens because it gives us an opportunity to spend some real time together today. So really excited for today's conversation and thank you so much for having me on the show.
There you go.
Absolutely. I would love if you would please share with our audience just a little bit about you and how you got into HR tech.
Yeah, totally. So I'm one of the co-founders and CEO of a business called HackAJob. I co-founded a business with a guy called Razvan, who I met at university or college back in London. At King's College London, we were both studying. And it was actually Razvan that had the initial idea for HackAJob. He had identified an opportunity to effectively understand somebody's skills and create more of a skills-based hiring approach from a sourcing perspective. And we'd worked on a few different projects together. And he approached me one day saying, Mark, I've got this idea and I'd love you to join me on this journey, which I'm super grateful that he did because it's fundamentally changed my life over the last 9 years. So we got to work on building HackAJob. We went through Techstars, we raised some investment, we raised some more investment to the point at which we turned 10 this year, which is crazy. So yeah, I've never had a professional job. This is the only one that I have done. And I've spent probably 100 hours a week for all of my 20s thinking about the problem of tech hiring and how we can build software and products to help companies hire technical people more effectively.
I'm curious how your co-founder came to this conclusion, right? So I'm assuming he's a software developer and he was having difficulties getting hired or he had challenges.
Yeah, so he is one of these rare, incredible people that is very technical, but also very commercial. So yes, he had done an undergrad in comp sci, but was doing a master's in business. And he had seen the world of recruitment agencies in the UK and different ways recruitment agencies worked. And how you kind of had non-technical people screening technical people, not really understanding what the technical person does, and then spamming CVs out to companies hoping they would hire them. Yeah. And that was really the insight, was actually, can we build some software that understands people's skills and then primarily use that as the primary data point.
Super interesting. I think that is what I would say has been most surprising about the third-party staffing industry. Because what you described is 100% true in North America as well. Most of these recruiters have zero experience and they're 100% commission. That means they will not be able to buy lunch if they don't make a placement. And so it drives desperation. It drives extremely high turnover. So that is remarkable that your co-founder would have that much savvy to figure it out. I spent 10 years working in that world. And I can tell you straight up, that is absolutely how most firms work. So talk a little bit more about what HackAJob does differently.
Yeah, totally. So our central hypothesis is that every company in the world is now a technology business. Technology has evolved from a standalone industry to a function that touches every industry. And therefore, the ability to engage, hire, retain technical talent is a boardroom priority for every organization. If you're going to build a successful company over the next decade, technology needs to be a core part of your strategy. The challenge often that companies face is that technical individuals are a slightly different breed to other job seekers. You know, over the last decade, there's always been more jobs than there has been candidates available. So they've been very used to having all of the power. They are generally not on the more popular hiring platforms like LinkedIn and Indeed, and those channels aren't really built for a technical audience. So generally where direct sourcing teams typically go to find talent, they often struggle with tech. You obviously have the growing importance of DE&I and how we build a more representative team within tech. Mm-hmm. And then obviously over the last 12 to 18 months, there's just been so much uncertainty in the hiring market. So that's the backdrop into why we exist. How we've approached solving that problem is by building a modular product suite that effectively impacts and solves every part of the hiring process. It starts, and probably what we're most famous for, is our two-sided marketplace. So here we onboard candidates into our community. Really important that it's all first-party data, so they become a HackerJob user. We take them through a job fit qualification where we're understanding their motivations, visa, salary, location, tech stack, all of that good stuff. We take them through a technical qualification where we'll actually validate their skills, and we've built a cloud-based IDE. We can also analyze open source projects, and they can also build out commercial work experience. And then the final part of the onboarding journey is an opt-in DE&I, which 80% of our users self-disclose. So really powerful data set. Mm-hmm. From there, our matching engine will predict how likely that candidate is to be interviewed by the companies that are hiring on HackerJob. And if they are, the candidate will be live or visible for a short period of time, about 4 weeks initially. And it's here where we flip the model. So rather than the candidate applying to the job, the company actually makes the first move and reaches out to the engineer. And this creates this like really magical candidate experience, because as a senior software engineer, I'm used to getting spammed nonstop about mostly completely irrelevant opportunities. Yeah. Whereas on HackerJob, I'm only going to get pitched by companies that meet my salary, visa, seniority, tech stack, location. So I filter all of that noise out to see the really relevant opportunities, which in turn means that companies get a 90% response rate. So you've just got this engagement that you don't have across any other channel. And so internal recruiters love it because they can spend a lot more time doing what they're elite at, which is engaging candidates, getting them through the interview process, and a lot less time just sending hundreds and hundreds of messages and not getting any responses. And then we pair that product with an employer brand solution, a DE&I solution, and an insight solution to really, like I say, touch every part of the hiring funnel.
Okay.
It's really interesting when we talk about two-sided marketplace, because I've lived in that world and it's extremely challenging, right? When we're talking about two-sided marketplace, obviously we're talking about the companies, we're talking about the job seekers. I'm really curious how you've created the engagement in depth with the candidate side, because obviously they're probably getting approached from different companies that are doing similar things, maybe not completely the same, but what really keeps that engagement with those job seekers?
So I think one of the most powerful things about what we've done is place the candidate experience at the heart of what we do. And so we've got a large community, right? Over 500,000 users on the system, but only a fraction of those users will be interviewing at any one point because we're really focused on engagement. So about 15,000 of our users will be interviewing with companies at any one point.
Wow.
Of those 15,000 users, a third are repeat users. So they found a job on HackerJob in the past, and then a couple of years later, they come back around and use us again. And that just speaks to the value that they're able to get from the solution. And then about another 20% of our users are referral and word of mouth users.
Okay.
So what we've been able to do is, as we've scaled the supply side, the candidate side of the business, we've been able to reduce our cost per acquisition, which is actually quite rare. As you scale, normally you'll see some expansion in your cost of acquisition. And one of the real magics of what we've done is taken the best of software, but also layered in a human approach. Mm. So it's really funny, and we'll talk about our scaling journey. We went on a journey of scaling our own product team, and we used HackerJob to do it. And 17 of the 18 hires we made for our own solution. And we got to then obviously speak to those engineers once they joined us and said, how was the experience? And the thing that all took them by surprise was every single candidate on HackerJob gets what we call a talent success manager. And that is somebody that is optional to help them through a hiring process. I think us that live and breathe recruitment sometimes forget just how big a deal it is to change your job. And they all thought that that was a bot, that actually it wasn't a real human and they wouldn't be able to speak to that real human. And actually, no, that's a real human. We have real humans that will be there to support our candidates if they want to. Now, some candidates will sign up to HackerJob, never engage that person and move on. But Shelley, to your point, those individuals are not commission-based. So they can actually be an independent third party to help coach a candidate. And the thing that we really measure them on is the candidate net promoter score. You know, how good was the experience for the candidate? So I think the way we've been able to scale the supply side, the candidate side of the marketplace, is by creating this really strong experience, which creates very high repeat users and very high referrals.
I just want to clarify, Mark, are job seekers being charged? Is there
no,
a fee?
No, absolutely not. No, so completely free for users. Yeah, completely free for our candidates. The way we monetize is we charge an annual subscription model to the employer, and we charge it in a way in which that we're a direct sourcing solution. So often people are reducing their reliance on third-party staffing agencies, where you might be paying 20, 30K or higher, and using our annual subscription model to reduce that by 75%. So yeah, we only charge employers completely free for candidates.
Okay, so then your talent success managers, are they working on behalf of the client company or the candidate? Again, maybe I'm falling back into the old-fashioned way of looking at this, because I want to spend my time with the highest likelihood of placement. So how do they get paid? Like, how would a talent success manager model work here?
Yeah, phenomenal question. So I think one of the issues with the third-party staffing agency model is the incentives are all misaligned. At the end of the day, we only get paid if that candidate gets hired, which then creates this environment where you want to force people into jobs. Because we don't get paid per placement, we have no incentive around whether the candidate accepts one job or the other. So the talent success manager is exclusively working for the candidate. They will never speak to the employer. I'll touch on the employer in a second. And what we have just decided as an organization is we're willing to bear the cost of that. So when you think about a P&L and you think about what sits in your costs of goods sold, what your COGS are, our talent success team will sit in there. And that's fine. We're willing to do that because we think the candidate experience is so important. What we do have on the employer side is our customer success team, and they will be working very closely with the employers and the individual recruiters using the platform and using the product. And that's great. And it's a very successful team for us. And obviously, we've invested in a lot of technology internally to make these workflows very efficient and effective so that the talent success team can really support the candidates that need the support, which again, isn't really about whether you're more likely or less likely to be successful. You might be a really senior software engineer, but you haven't changed jobs in 6 years. So actually, the talent success manager is really valuable to you. You might be a graduate who's interviewing at 25 different companies and like, I get interviewing right now. I don't need another person speaking to me about interviewing. I just want to manage this directly with the employer. And that's why we really let the candidate dictate that journey.
Wow. Okay. Thank you.
I want to jump into some of the hot topics that are happening in the industry and get your thoughts around it. One hot topic is definitely skills-based hiring. And I know that's how you base the foundation of your company. What's your overall thoughts here as far as skill-based hiring, where it's going? What are the challenges that we're going to see as organizations start moving to that approach instead of the old resume, college degree requirement type of approach?
Yeah, I think it's generally a positive move for several reasons. Firstly, I think as TA functions and as TA leaders, we need to get more proactive in our sourcing.
Yeah.
And I think the old model of a job requisition gets released, it's got some really strict requirements against it, we're going to react against those requirements, find some candidates, come back to the job rec and hope we fit it. It effectively makes us service delivery people to hiring managers to the organization. Yeah. I think the opportunity with skills-based hiring is to understand the skills that your organization generally hire for and then constantly be talent pipelining in those areas so that when a requisition comes, you've already engaged, you've already mapped the market, you know who you want to go forward with. So I think that's a big step forward. I think the other big step forward is that generally when I'm hiring, I care about the skills that you have. I don't really care about the college that you went to or the previous employer that you've worked on. And so you would hope over time that there is a positive impact on representation because we should be removing some of that unconscious bias filtering. I'm always fascinated when what I would call maybe a more industry trend coincides with a tech trend. And I know we're going to touch on Gen AI as well. One of the challenges with skills-based hiring is the skills taxonomy itself. Mm. How do you keep a skills taxonomy up to date? How do you keep the relationship between skills up to date? What does that end up looking like? And how do you do that in a way that's useful for a human? On HackerJob, there are like 50,000 different skills that a candidate could have. And each of those skills are going to have some level of relationship to each other. That is clearly a fantastic problem for AI to go and solve because it can handle far more data than a human brain can handle. Mm. And what's fascinating with generative AI specifically and LLMs is potentially the use of synthetic data to actually build skill taxonomies in the first place. When you've got the industry shift to skills-based hiring combined with a tech shift or a tech enablement with what's happening with LLMs makes it a really exciting move. I think it's something that the most forward-thinking TA organizations will do. I don't think it's where everyone's going to end up. Yeah. I think there will still be a lot of people that end up in that kind of more service-based model of responding to requisitions as they get released. Generally speaking, it's a positive step forward.
I love that response, because what seems to be so overwhelming for most organizations is understanding the taxonomy and the relationship for each job. Because the possibilities, when you really dig into it, could be infinite. And so most organizations don't have something at the ready where they can do this. I might throw you off a bit here, but are you strictly focused in technology, software development? Are there any thoughts at HackAJob to look at other industries where the problem also exists?
Yeah, it's one of the perennial questions in the history of HackAJob. So we have definitely expanded the areas that we now cover. So we started software engineering. We now cover 150 different job titles across about 35 different job categories. We took the quite brave decision about a year ago now to actually rebuild our core matching engine from scratch because of what's possible with LLMs combined with our first party data. It's like a really magic combination. Mm-hmm. And historically, we've been very focused on technical skills, what you might have considered hard skills in the past. But if you go and speak to a CTO and you ask them what makes your best software engineers the best, a lot of them are what you would consider soft skills, problem solving, communication, mm-hmm. leadership, all of that stuff. So what we're really excited about in our new matching engine, and again, what kind of some LLMs enable you to do with different skills taxonomies, is blend technical skills or what you might consider hard skills with soft skills and actually blend that into the matching. And I'm sure we're going to touch on Gen AI in lots of different ways, but you can now use unstructured requirements to start your search when you're looking for talent. And that might be, find me a Java engineer that works in a really collaborative environment that's demonstrated leadership skills. That's like a search you've never been able to run before, because you would have had to have the keyword communication skills and the keyword leadership and the keyword Java. Now you can do so much more in how you think about matching that. So that's really interesting. Will we go beyond tech in the broadest definition of tech? I think it's unlikely. My primary reason for saying that is we predominantly work with enterprise organizations. And it comes back to my first statement. Every industry is now a technology business. Yeah. And so we work across a vast range of industries. And therefore, there isn't a natural job category for us to go and tackle next where we could help our existing customers. If there was, that would be where we're most interested by. Instead, we're more interested in how we expand our geo reach. So we're doing an experiment in India at the moment. And we're going to keep pushing the boundaries on where we can support people from a global tech sourcing perspective.
Let's talk about Gen AI. There's two sides of it. There's companies and how they're leveraging it, but there's also candidates. And the way candidates are using it is potentially causing some issues with recruiters. So what's your thoughts around Gen AI when it comes to candidates and how they're leveraging and the possible challenges that's going to cause for talent acquisition departments in general?
Yeah, I almost feel sorry right now for some of the tools that have been created for candidates, because I think they're trying to game the system that can't be gamed. So the two big ones that you're seeing is resumes being created based off a job description. So it looks like you're the perfect candidate for the job. And then like lazy apply, just go and apply to like 500 jobs for me.
Yeah.
And again, if I can understand there being some level of personalization in your resume against the job description. To me, that makes sense. We used to do that with cover letters. Fine. I think the challenge with that is people are gaming the system. But ultimately, if you don't have the skills to get the job, you're just going to waste your time either interviewing and fading in the interview process, or actually getting hired because you managed to kind of somehow get your way through the whole system, but then doing a really bad job and getting fired anyway.
Yeah.
So I think candidates can leverage these tools in a way that might enable them to get a foot in the door. Maybe they do get that interview. But I really think we should be building tools that enable candidates to find the right companies for them, the right jobs for them, where they're going to be the most successful. I'm still bewildered at some of the major job sites and how bad their job recommendation services are to candidates. The jobs that I get recommended on the major platforms have nothing to do with my experience. So I would much rather we focused on using Gen AI to really personalize that candidate experience, which I think is really exciting, and set up candidates for success, rather than this first wave of tools, which bluntly is just creating a hell of a lot of noise, a lot of spam, creating a really bad recruiter experience. So recruiters are drowning with irrelevant applications right now. The first wave of these tools, I don't think has really helped candidates, generally speaking.
Obviously, you've built tools, you've leveraged LLMs, and you've started building on Gen AI as well. there are thousands of companies that have launched AI tools in our space, and it's just creating noise for a lot of recruiters and practitioners that are trying to figure out what's real and what's not. So what's your advice for a practitioner, a talent acquisition leader? How do they assess this?
Yeah. When we were at HR Tech in Vegas, it was hilarious to me how everyone was suddenly an AI company. There's a Steve Jobs quote, and I hate quoting Steve Jobs because I always feel very like a bit of an imposter quoting somebody like him. But he has this brilliant line that's really shaped our product strategy at HackerJob, which is the end consumer, so in this case, a head of TA, fundamentally does not care about the technology you're using to solve their problem. No. They just want their problem solved 10 times better than what it was before. And one of the challenges of being a founder of a technology business is there's always new technology waves coming forward. And what is a new way to do something? What is actually just not applicable for us? So Web3 and crypto was very exciting, and people tried to build some interesting blockchain apps in our space. We never saw an interesting use case. We could not ever think that this technology solves our customers' problem 10 times better. When LLMs came to market and ChatGPT-3, whenever it was in back end of 22, our approach was, let's run an internal hackathon. Let's just spend some time on it for a week and see if there's something new here. And we genuinely believe there are new novel approaches that LLMs enable that were not possible before.
Yeah.
If I'm a head of TA and I'm trying to buy a new vendor, I would not be focused on the technology that they are using. It does not matter if they have built their own LLM, if they are a very thin wrapper over a ChatGPT type product, if they're doing some basic regression analysis, like, are they providing some software that makes my job better, that solves my problem, etc.? And I think that people get caught up in the latest trends, the latest buzzes a little bit too much. We as founders and as CEOs of businesses know it. So we'll lean heavily into product marketing because we know that people are going to get caught up in it. But I would just be really challenging any vendor to say, like, how are you actually solving my problem? And I think if you want to generally use AI in a completely new way, you need first-party data. You need to actually own a data asset. And so another question that I would be asking these people is, do you own your data? Or is this actually just a very thin layer on top of an already built LLM, or actually just scraping third-party data, which is always a ton of risk in? So ultimately, the technology that a company is using bluntly doesn't matter. What matters is, can you solve my problem in a new, novel way that makes a key metric for me improve?
I love it. But let's jump into your journey here. Let's talk a little bit about HackerJob and how you scaled, because from 2022 to 2023, you went from 75 to 150 employees. That is a massive leap for any organizations. Usually 50 to 100, a lot of things start crashing and burning, and there's a lot of challenges that come with it. So I'm curious, when you went from 75 to 150, first of all, what is your talent acquisition process? You're leveraging HackerJob for a lot of those roles, but how did that flow? How do you hire?
Yeah, great question. So for the tech roles, we leveraged HackerJob, like I said, for like 17 out of the 18 roles that we hired in that space. And that was amazing. There's like a concept in our world called dog fooding, where you use your own product. So we got a lot of product feedback from using it ourselves, which was awesome. So that was great. Outside of that, we have still a really strong internal recruitment function. So we, you know, absolutely believe in direct sourcing. And I think we've got a very attractive employer brand. I think we're well known in the space. And I think we did a really great job of leveraging that. And I would be lying if I sat here and said we had this perfect interview process and everyone had interview scorecards and everything. If you're going from 75 to 150 people, it's chaos. Like, it's internally chaos. And I actually quite like chaos. I don't mind that at all. And a key part of that journey was really leveling up our exec team. So we brought in a new VP of finance, a new VP of product, a new VP of sales. For those roles, we used search firms. So we actually went to market and partnered with search firms. So we used a mishmash of different strategies and tactics. I would say, and I dubbed this phrase last year, we definitely got caught up in momentum hiring. So in 2022, the business was just crushing it. Like every month, every quarter, we were growing so quickly, we couldn't keep up. Like it was every founder's dream. The charts are just up and to the right. And I think we got too quick to say yes to everybody wanting to hire, right? In that moment, and it's chaos, everybody is like, Mark, we need another X. We need another Y. We need another Z. Let's just go. Let's go hire. And I don't think I had the maturity. I'd never seen this before. To actually take a step back and be like, okay, are we actually adding the right people? Are we adding the people where we need to add the people? Is there actually process changes that we can make to drive efficiencies? Is there products that we could buy to drive efficiencies? And I think one of my big lessons is not to get caught up in momentum hiring and actually to challenge requisitions a little bit more when they come to us, rather than just saying yes to everything because right now is good. And I think a lot of founders went through that lesson in 2022. Maybe not everyone would admit it, but I think a lot of us made some pretty similar mistakes in that time.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was a workforce planning strategy before you started hiring, or it was just, it came in and you're like, yes, let's hire that person and pretty much just moved along with how the industry was going.
Speaking very candidly, it depended on the maturity of the leaders running the function. Okay. So the approach that we took in product and engineering was very methodical, very strategic. We were going from one product squad to three product squads, introducing two new support squads. And Pete, our VP of product, and Vlad, our VP of Eng, nailed it out beautifully, very clear. And almost in some respects in product, it's almost slightly easier to do workforce planning because you can tie it to a product roadmap, where you're going, what the strategic direction is. I think where we were probably too reactive is in more of the roles that are directly interfacing with customers. It's like, we're onboarding more customers. Great. Hire more customer success people. Hire more salespeople. Hire more account managers. Just go. And what should have reflected on was, okay, where are we forecasting to be? What happens if we miss a forecast? Where do we course correct? What does that end up looking like? So I think in the commercial GTM functions, we probably had less of a plan and we were probably being a little bit more caught up in that momentum hiring versus in that kind of product and end world where we had a bit more of a plan that we were working to.
Did you have a talent acquisition team?
Yeah. So Elena, I think every startup has an Elena. Elena is like our Swiss Army knife, who has basically done every role in the business. She's currently on mat leave, but has done everything. And so Elena was heading up our TA team. And then we had a number of internal recruiters in the UK and in Romania. We've got a big team in Romania. So we did do a lot through internal. We used search for senior roles. And there was a handful of roles that we still went to before as well.
What does your tech stack look like outside of HackerJob? Do you have an ATS? Do you have any of those tools?
Yeah, great question, actually. So we're workable from an ATS perspective. Yeah. And so another European HR tech business has done phenomenally well. We're HiBob from a HRIS system. And they're crushing it. God, they've just done another amazing fundraise. We introduced Lattice, which I was initially very skeptical of. It felt like too big a tool for the stage that we are at. But I think the discipline it brings to one-to-ones and performance reviews is really strong. And I think one of the big culture changes in startups over the last 12 months is it used to be a KPI that you were growing headcount. Like I report to our investors, guys, we added 20 heads this month or this quarter. We must be doing something well. And now it's really about being challenged. How do you do more with less? And so actually now performance management is the most important thing. So we brought in a new VP of people at the end of last year. And to me, there's like different profiles you could go for in that kind of people leadership. There is somebody that's great at TA and is great at doubling heads each year. There's somebody that's great at kind of HR and compliance, or there's somebody that's more kind of learning, development, performance, culture, et cetera. And we really optimized for the latter, somebody that had a background in learning and development, performance management, performance culture, because that's what we need to be now. We need to be a leaner organization. We are smaller than what we were at our peak. We did do some restructures. We did change the shape of the organization. And now it's about being challenged to do more of less. So Lattice is a really great tool in facilitating that.
Something you just brought up was the fact that you're originally founded in the UK, and you have staff in Romania. And I know that right now, as we speak, you're sitting in New York. There have been so many firms that see the United States of America as this pot of gold, and very few actually break through in the US market. And what's interesting is when you refer to companies like Workable and HiBob, they've figured something out about how business is done globally. So would you mind sharing just a little bit about where are you at with breaking into the US market? Is it what you thought it was going to be? Anything that you can share with the audience about the success you've had?
Some of these comments are going to be incredibly naive, but in the spirit of vulnerability, I will share them. So we've now been in the US for about 2 years. One of the advantages that we had is we generally work with enterprise companies that are global. So we were able to launch the US with a bunch of existing customers, which was really helpful. And they've been cornerstones for us. The things that have gone well, when you launch a new market, serendipity plays such a big part. And I'll give you a great example. I got intro to Joe Wilkie, HR Joe. We went for coffee. He introduced me to our friends over at Chad and Cheese. I caught up with Chad. Chad then introduced me to Josh Gamble, who founded Recruitix. And now Josh is in the business working with me as a consultant every day and adding so much value, right? And it's like that chain of events is so random. Like I couldn't have planned that. That wasn't part of our big strategic goals. But having Josh inside our company who has built and scaled a US organization is so valuable. And at the end of the day, it all comes back to talent. We were very fortunate. Our first sales hire in the US was a guy called Brett, who's absolutely crushing it for us and is now running the team. We've done a brilliant job of taking some of our UK people and bringing them to the US. Mm. And it's a small team here. It's 8 or 9 people in New York. But I love that. It's like back to the old days of Hackajob when we're a really small team. And we're making really good progress, really good momentum. Again, one of the reasons we've been able to do that is identify 1 or 2 verticals that we're doing really well in. So we're doing a lot in the cleared talent space. It's one of the unique things about Hackajob is we're able to match against cleared talent. So we're doing a lot in Virginia and Maryland and DC and different areas like that, which has worked really well. I think the challenges of launching in the US, there are so many. And again, somebody's going to sound incredibly naive. We speak a similar language, but not the same language. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's harder in many respects to understand the nuance between British English and American English than it is to speak between UK and French, because the languages are obviously so different.
Yeah.
And US organizations, and I don't mean this as a disrespect at all, are relatively confident in that they don't care what we've done in the UK. We're the US. We're bigger, yeah. We're more complicated, we've got more process, etc. So you need to prove what you can do here. And you need to sound like an American company. There's no like this British charm. No, you need to come and solve our US problems. And you need to deeply understand the US market. And I think that speaks to the third thing, which is, again, incredibly naive. I didn't appreciate how big the US was until I flew from New York to San Diego, which is a longer flight than New York to London. Mm-hmm. And so as you think about tackling the US, you can't just host a strategic TA leader dinner like you could in London and get all the strategic TA leaders there, right? They're dotted around everywhere. Yeah. How do you then build a location strategy around that? How do you make sure that you're not trying to go after too much? So overall, I'm really happy with the progress we've made. I think the US economy is in a better place than the UK economy, which also helps with that. But yeah, we've made a ton of mistakes and learnings too.
So Mark, I'm curious, if someone came up to you and gives you $1 billion for Hackajob, you sell it, you exit, you're happy. Now you're going to start a new company and you got to build out that company. You're going to scale it. What would you do differently than you did at Hackajob?
Yeah, my co-founder and I have discussed this so much. I don't think you can cheat product market fit. So a lot of people talk about serial entrepreneurs and how they're a de-risked investment because they've done it before. I don't care if you founded 1 startup or 10 startups, the process of finding product market fit will take as long as it takes. Mm. There is a process to it and you need to know that process, but you should know that process if you're a first-time founder. There's so much content out there now. So I actually think going through the product market fit phase is very little I would change. You need to be obsessed with customers. You need to be speaking to them every day. You need to be rapidly prototyping. You can't be building stuff in isolation for 6 months and then taking it to a customer. You've got to go through that rapid prototype. I think what changes completely the second time around is just how quickly you can scale go to market. And ultimately, if you're going to build a big company, distribution is where it's at. Actually, go to market matters more than product in so many instances. Once you've got product market fit, and I think just building that muscle, I now know how to build a sales team, a customer success team, what they should look like. I now know the difference between whether we should optimize for outbound prospecting or generating inbound leads. And I just think that muscle is a muscle that you build. And you ultimately understand that the people inside the company is everything. All a company is the output of the people that work there. So your ability to hire exceptional people is really the difference between whether you're going to be successful or not. I think in the early phase of product market fit, you can't cheat it. It's going to take time. You need to follow the process. I think it's how quickly you can get to scale after that, which is really obsessing over the people you bring in, building a really great culture, and then just those playbooks that you've learned that really enable you to go quicker the second, third, fourth time around.
Well, I guess we'll see when you start your second company a couple of years from now, I'm expecting. Mark, I want to close it off on this. One of the things that I've noticed from you is you're working really hard to build your personal brand. And obviously, at the same time, you're building Hackajob's brand. For founders or even recruiters, right? Like, how important is it to build your own personal brand in this current landscape?
So I'm conflicted on this because I definitely have invested in it. And so I'm doing podcasts and very vocal on LinkedIn. And I'm conflicted because I don't feel like I've achieved enough to come out here and be like this big oracle and I know all of this information. But there's a bit of that imposter syndrome in there. However, having said that, I think as the face of an organization, you have to be present. And where are our customers? They live on LinkedIn. So I need to be very present on LinkedIn. If our customers live on Twitter, I'll spend more of my time on Twitter. That's the reality. I think what advantage does a personal brand give you? It gives you distribution. So when we've got an update, I can now share it on LinkedIn and I've got 10,000 followers that are going to see that update, right? That is distribution. So if you apply that to recruiters, if I'm trying to build a personal brand, I would probably be trying to build a personal brand in the space in which I'm trying to recruit, so that when I've got a new requisition, I can go to my people that follow me and be like, great, I'm now hiring for a senior Python engineer, come and interview with me. And there's some great examples of people. I mean, HR Joe, who I touched on, Joe Wilkie, is doing a phenomenal job of building a personal brand in this space. I do think that as a founder CEO, like, you have to be public. You have to be out there. So much of my job is sales, whether that be selling customers, employees, investors. And I think having a personal brand out there is really important. Choose your channels. I think it's very easy to get caught up in your own hype. So have some good people around you that are willing to bring you back down to earth. But I do think it's worthwhile investing in.
So, Mark, this was amazing. Such great insights. We really appreciate you coming back on. If anyone's trying to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Actually, email. I'm like obsessive about how I manage my inbox. So mark@hackerjob.com. Feel free to connect me on LinkedIn. I just find LinkedIn so noisy in the inbox. It's so hard to like find the signal from the noise. So yeah, feel free to just drop me an email. I'm on Twitter. I don't really tweet. I'm one of those people that just lurks in the background on Twitter or X.
I am exactly the same. So Mark, this was great. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. It was wonderful to spend time with you again, Mark.
And thank you guys. I love the show. Thank you so much for having me on, and look forward to catching up in person soon.
Me too.
Au revoir. Thank you. Shelley, let's face it. Texting candidates is the easiest way to hire quicker today. But your cell phone doesn't connect to your ATS. You're sharing your personal number with strangers. That's pretty scary, right, Shelley? And it's not even legally compliant.
This is where our friends at RecText come in. They've created simple yet powerful text recruiting software that works with your ATS. Plus, it's designed by recruiters for recruiters, so you know it works. To learn more and book a demo, visit www.rectxt.com. Mention the Recruitment Flex and get 10% off annual plans.
Welcome, change agents, to your go-to place for stories that ignite your spirit, fuel your purpose, and connect us all. We believe in the incredible power of the human spirit, its boundless resilience, and the inspiration it brings to our lives. On the Driving Change podcast, we'll journey together through the extraordinary yet very relatable experiences of some of the most amazing people on earth. Our mission? That through these stories, we might just spark change within you and awaken a newfound motivation to harness your unique gifts to make a real difference in the world. So get ready to be inspired and join us on this incredible adventure. You can find the Driving Change podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you love listening to your favorite podcasts.